4.4. In his 3 years as a high school student in the New Jersey suburbs, the 16, 17, and 18-year-old Ferguson started 27 short stories, finished 19 of them, and spent no less than 1 hour every day with what he called his work notebooks, which he filled with various writing exercises he invented for himself in order to stay sharp, dig down, and try to get better, as he once put it to Amy. Descriptions of physical objects, landscapes, morning skies, human faces, animals, the effect of light on snow, the sound of rain on glass, the smell of burning wood, the sensation of walking through fog, or listening to wind blow through the branches of trees. Monologues in the voices of other people, in order to become those other people, or at least try to understand them better. His father, his mother, his stepfather, Amy, Noah, his teachers, his friends at school, Mr. and Mrs. Fetterman. But also unknown and more distant others such as J.S. Bach, Franz Kafka, the checkout girl at the local supermarket, the ticket collector on the Erie Lackawanna Railroad, and the bearded panhandler who cadged a dollar from him in Grand Central Station. Imitations of admired, demanding, inimitable writers from the past. Take a paragraph from Hawthorne, for example, and compose something based on his syntactical model, using a verb wherever he used a verb, a noun wherever he used a noun, an adjective wherever he used an adjective, in order to feel the rhythms in your bones, to feel how the music was made. A curious sequence of vignettes generated by puns, homonyms, and one-letter displacements of words. Ale, A-I-L, ale, A-L-E. Lust, lost. Soul, soil. Birth, B-I-R-T-H, birth, B-E-R-T-H. And impetuous jags of automatic writing to clear his brain whenever he was feeling stuck. As with a four-page scribble gush inspired by the word nomad that began, "No, I am not mad, nor am I even angry, but give me a chance to discombobulate you, and I'll pick your pockets clean." He also wrote one one-act play, which he burned in disgust 1 week after finishing it, and 23 of the foulest stinker poems ever hatched by a citizen of the New World, which he tore up after promising himself never to write another poem again. He mostly hated what he did. He mostly thought he was stupid and talentless and would never amount to anything. But still he persisted, driving himself to keep at it every day in spite of the often disappointing results, understanding there would be no hope for him unless he kept at it, that becoming the writer he wanted to be would necessarily take years, more years than it would take for his body to finish growing. And every time he wrote something that seemed slightly less bad than the piece that had come before it, he sensed he was making progress, even if the next piece turned out to be an abomination. For the truth was that he didn't have a choice. He was destined to do this or die, because notwithstanding his struggles and dissatisfaction with the dead things that often came out of him, the act of doing it made him feel more alive than anything else he had ever done. And when the words began to sing in his ears, and he sat down at his desk and picked up his pen or put his fingers on the keys of his typewriter, he felt naked, naked and exposed to the big world rushing in on him. And nothing felt better than that. Nothing could equal the sensation of disappearing from himself and entering the big world humming inside the words that were humming inside his head. Stubborn. That was the word that best described him during those years. And every year more stubborn than the year before, more locked into himself, more unwilling to budge when someone or something pushed up against him. Ferguson had grown hard. Hard in his contempt for his father, hard in the abnegations he continued to impose on himself years after Artie Fetterman's death. Hard in his opposition to the suburban society that had held him prisoner since the beginning of his conscious life. If Ferguson hadn't yet turned into an insufferable scold who made people flee from him the moment he walked into a room, it was because he didn't look for fights and generally kept his thoughts to himself. Most of his fellow high school students saw him as an okay sort of guy, a bit morose at times, a bit lost in his own head, but not someone with a chip on his shoulder, and definitely not a bore, since Ferguson wasn't against all people, only some people, and the people he wasn't against, he tended to like, and the people he liked, he treated with a reserved but thoughtful affection, and the people he loved in the way a dog loves, with every part of himself, never judging, never condemning, never thinking an ill thought, simply worshipping them and exulting in their presence, for he knew he was utterly dependent on the small band of people who loved him and whom he loved back, and that without them he would have been lost. Another Hank or Frank, tumbling down the shaft of the all-devouring incinerator, a flake of ash floating across the night sky. He was no longer the boy who had written Soulmates as a 14-year-old nitwit nobody. But he still carried that boy inside him, and he sensed that the two of them would go on walking together for a long time to come. To combine the strange with the familiar, that was what Ferguson aspired to. To observe the world as closely as the most dedicated realist, and yet to create a way of seeing the world through a different, slightly distorting lens. For reading books that dwelled only on the familiar inevitably taught you things you already knew, and reading books that dwelled only on the strange taught you things you didn't need to know. And what Ferguson wanted above all else was to write stories that would make room not only for the visible world of sentient beings and inanimate things, but also for the vast and mysterious unseen forces that were hidden within the scene. He wanted to disturb and disorient, to make people roar with laughter and tremble in their boots, to break hearts and damage minds and dance the loony dance of the Dizzy Boys as they swung into their doppelganger duet. Yes, Tolstoy was ever so moving, and yes, Flaubert wrote the best sentences in creation, but much as Ferguson enjoyed following the dramatic, increasingly drastic turns in the lives of Anna Kay and Emma B., at that moment in his life, the characters who spoke most forcefully to him were Kafka's Kay, Swift's Gulliver, Poe's Pym, Shakespeare's Prospero, Melville's Bartleby, Gogol's Kovalyov, and M. Shelley's Monster. Early efforts from his sophomore year. A story about a man who wakes up one morning to discover he has a different face. A story about a man who loses his wallet and passport in a foreign city and sells his blood in order to eat. A story about a little girl who changes her name on the first day of every month. A story about two friends who stop being friends because of a dispute in which both of their arguments are wrong. A story about a man who accidentally kills his wife and then decides to paint every house in his neighborhood a bright shade of red. A story about a woman who loses the power of speech and finds herself growing progressively happier as the years go on. A story about a teenage boy who runs away from home and then, when he decides to return, discovers that his parents have vanished. A story about a young man writing a story about a young man, writing a story about a young man, writing a story about a young man. Hemingway taught him to look at his sentences more carefully, how to measure the weight of each word and syllable that went into the building of a paragraph. But admirable as Hemingway's writing could be when he was writing at his best, his work didn't say much to Ferguson. All that manly bluster and tight-lipped stoicism seemed slightly ridiculous to him. So he left Hemingway behind for the deeper, more demanding Joyce. And then, when he turned 16, another bundle of paperbacks was given to him by Uncle Don, among them books by the heretofore unknown Isaac Babel, who quickly became Ferguson's number one short story writer in the world, and Heinrich von Kleist, the subject of Don's first biography, who quickly became Ferguson's number two short story writer. But even more valuable to him, not to say precious and everlastingly fundamental, was the 45-cent signet edition of Walden and Civil Disobedience that was wedged in among the books of fiction and poetry. For even if Thoreau wasn't a writer of novels or short stories, he was a writer of sublime clarity and precision, a creator of such beautifully constructed sentences that Ferguson felt their beauty as one feels a blow to the chin or a fever in the brain. Perfect. Every word seemed to fall perfectly in place, and every sentence seemed to be a small work unto itself, an independent unit of breath and thought. And the thrill of reading such prose was never knowing how far Thoreau would leap from one sentence to the next. Sometimes it was only a matter of inches, sometimes of several feet or yards, sometimes of whole country miles. And the destabilizing effect of those irregular distances taught Ferguson how to think about his own efforts in a new way. For what Thoreau did was to combine two opposing and mutually exclusive impulses in every paragraph he wrote, what Ferguson began to call the impulse to control and the impulse to take risks. That was the secret, he felt. All control would lead to an airless, suffocating result. All risk would lead to chaos and incomprehensibility. But put the two together, and then maybe you'd be onto something. Then maybe the words singing in your head would start to sing on the page, and bombs would go off, and buildings would collapse, and the world would begin to look like a different world. But there was more to Thoreau than just style. There was the savage need to be himself and no one but himself, even at the cost of offending his neighbors. The stubbornness of soul that so appealed to the ever more stubborn Ferguson. The adolescent Ferguson, who saw in Thoreau a man who had managed to remain an adolescent for his entire life, which is to say, a man who had never abandoned his principles, who had never turned into a corrupt, sellout grown-up, a brave boy to the bitter end, which was precisely how Ferguson wanted to imagine his own future. But beyond the spiritual imperative to transform himself into a bold, self-reliant being, there was Thoreau's critical examination of the American premise that money rules all, the rejection of the American government and his willingness to go to jail in order to protest that government's actions. And then, of course, there was the idea that had changed the world, the idea that had helped make India an independent country 5 months after Ferguson was born, which was the same idea now spreading across the American South and perhaps would help change America as well. Civil disobedience, nonviolent resistance to the violence of unjust laws, and how little had changed in the 112 years since Walden, Ferguson told himself. The Mexican-American War now turned into the Vietnam War. Black slavery now turned into Jim Crow oppression and Klan-run state governments. And just as Thoreau had written his book in the years leading up to the Civil War, Ferguson felt that he too was writing at a moment when the world was about to blow apart again. And three times in the weeks before and after his mother married Jim and Amy's father, as he watched the televised images and studied the newspaper photographs of Buddhist monks in South Vietnam, burning themselves to death to protest the policies of the American-backed Diem regime, Ferguson understood that the quiet days of his boyhood were over, that the horror of those immolations proved that if men were willing to die for peace, then the steadily expanding war in their country would eventually become so big that it would obscure everything and end up making everyone go blind. The new house was in South Orange, not Maplewood. But since the two towns were governed by a single board of education, Ferguson and Amy stayed on as students at Columbia High School, which was the only public high school in the district. They had already finished their sophomore year when their parents were married on August 2, 1963. And the dispiriting conversation that had taken place in the backyard of Ferguson's old house 11 months earlier was all but forgotten. Amy had found herself a boyfriend, Ferguson had found himself a girlfriend, and their brother-sister friendship had forged on just as Amy had hoped it would, although now that they were actually brother and sister, perhaps the old metaphor had become a trifle redundant. Ferguson's father was taking all the money from the sale of the old house, but Dan Schneiderman still owned the old house, the first Maplewood house, which young Ferguson had never wanted to leave. and by selling that house for $29,000, he had been able to buy the somewhat larger house in South Orange for $36,000. For even though Ferguson's mother was nearly penniless, because the monthly checks from his father had stopped coming after she married Dan, Dan himself was no longer broke, since he and Liz had both taken out $150,000 life insurance policies early in their marriage, and now that he had collected that sum in the wake of Liz's hideous, premature death, the newly formed family of Adlers, Fergusons, and Schneidermans was comfortably solvent for the time being. It was hard not to think about where the money had come from, the gruesome translation of terminal cancer into dollars. But Liz was dead, and life was moving on. And what choice did any of them have but to move along with it? They all loved the new house, even Ferguson, who was strongly opposed to living in a small town, who would have given almost anything to move to New York or any other large city, anywhere in the world, admitted that it was a fine choice, and that the two-story white clapboard house built in 1903 and situated on an out-of-the-way cul-de-sac known as Woodhull Crescent was a far better place to park your bones than the chilly castle of silence he had been forced to live in for the past 7 years. They probably could have used one more bedroom on top of the four they had, since the room that would have been Jim's was converted into a studio for Dan. But no one saw it as a hardship, least of all the phlegmatic Jim, who visited only rarely and seemed content to sleep on the living room sofa. And if he didn't mind, why should anyone else mind? The important thing was that they were all in it together. And because Ferguson approved of Dan, and Amy and Jim approved of Ferguson's mother, and Dan approved of Ferguson, and Ferguson's mother approved of Amy and Jim, they all settled in peacefully together and paid no attention to the gossips in the two towns who felt that with all the twists and commotions of the past year, death, divorce, remarriage, a new house, and two sexed-up teenagers living side by side on the same floor in that house, something strange or unnatural or not quite right must have been going on over there at 7 Woodhull Crescent. The man was nothing more than a struggling artist, for pity's sake, meaning a slovenly, wisecracking Luftmensch, according to the Jews, or a long-haired nonconformist with doubtful political leanings, according to the non-Jews. And how could Stanley Ferguson's wife have walked out on her marriage and all the money that came with it to join forces with a character like that? The biggest change for Ferguson had nothing to do with his mother's marriage to Dan Schneiderman. She had been married before, after all, and in that Dan was a better, more compatible husband for her than his father had been, Ferguson endorsed the union and didn't think about it much because he didn't have to. What he did think about, however, and what represented a far more significant upheaval in the basic conditions of his life, was that he was no longer an only child. As a young boy, he had prayed for a brother or a sister. Again and again he had begged his mother to produce a baby for him so he wouldn't be alone anymore. But then she had told him it wouldn't be possible, that she had no more babies in her, which meant that he would be her one and only Archie until the end of time. And little by little Ferguson had come to terms with his solitary fate, evolving into the pensive, dreamy fellow who now wanted to spend his adulthood sequestered in a room writing books. Missing out on the rough and tumble joys and high-spirited camaraderie that most children live through with their siblings, but also avoiding the conflicts and hatreds that can turn childhood into a hellish, unrelenting brawl that ends in lifelong bitterness and/or permanent psychosis, and now, at the age of 16, having eluded both the good and the bad of not being the only one for his entire life, Ferguson's childhood wish had been granted in the form of a 16-year-old sister and a 20-year-old brother. But too late, too long deferred to be of much use to him anymore. And even though Jim was mostly absent and Amy was his close friend again, after a long spell of resenting her for having turned him down the previous summer, there were days when he couldn't help longing for his old life as an only child, even if that life had been much worse than this one. It would have been different if Amy had loved him in the way he had come to love her. if they had taken advantage of their new circumstances to indulge in various sorts of carnal mischief. Impromptu hanky-panky sessions when their parents' backs were turned, secret lust frolics and midnight assignations in either one of their adjacent bedrooms, culminating in the mutual sacrifice of their two virginities to the cause of love and greater mental health. But Amy wasn't interested. She really and truly just wanted to be his sister. And the sex-mad Ferguson, whose primary goal in life was to stick his penis into a naked girl's body and put his virginhood behind him forever, had to go along with it or else explode from the continual agitation of wanting what he couldn't have. For thwarted desire was a poison that seeped into every part of you. And once your veins and inner organs were fully saturated with the stuff, it traveled upward toward your brain and burst right through the top of your skull. The early weeks in the new house were the most difficult for him. Not only did he have to suppress the urge to grab hold of Amy and smear her face with kisses every time they were alone together, and not only did he have to tamp down the nighttime erection reveries of slipping into bed with her in the room next door, but there were numerous practical adjustments that had to be made as well, which largely revolved around the question of how not to infringe on each other's privacy. And until they established a set of hard and fast rules about how to coexist in the spaces they shared, knock first, tidy up the bathroom before leaving it, wash your own dishes, don't crib the other's homework unless the answer is freely given to you, and no snooping in the other's room, which meant that Ferguson couldn't peek at Amy's diary, and Amy couldn't peek at Ferguson's work notebooks and stories. There were several awkward moments, and a couple of downright embarrassments, as when Amy opened the bathroom door and saw the freshly showered Ferguson sitting naked on the toilet, jerking off. "I didn't see that," she yelped as she slammed the door shut. Or when Ferguson popped out of his room at the precise instant Amy was walking down the hall, trying to adjust the towel that was wrapped around her body. And when the towel suddenly fell off, unveiling the whiteness of her bare skin to the startled Ferguson, who was looking at the small nippled breasts and curly brown pubes of his stepsister for the first time, Amy let out a loud, "Fuck," which Ferguson answered with an almost witty retort. "I always suspected you had a body," he said. "Now I'm sure of it." And Amy laughed, then raised her arms in a mock cheesecake pose and said, "Now we're even, Mr. Dick," which referred not only to the funny character in their beloved David Copperfield, but to what she had seen in the bathroom several days earlier. It was true that Ferguson had a girlfriend, but it was also true that he would have dropped her in an instant if Amy's Barkus had been willing. But it wasn't, and now that Ferguson had seen the body that would never be given to him, he no longer had to torture himself with trying to imagine what it looked like. And that was a small step forward, he felt, a way to begin curing himself of an unhealthy obsession that would never take him anywhere except into the bottomless well of eternal sadness. And by way of recompense, he tried to fix his thoughts on his girlfriend's body, which he had seen naked only from the waist up so far. But their explorations were becoming bolder and more reckless now that they had been reunited at the start of their junior year, which meant there was cause for hope. And after a rough summer of not knowing where he stood with Amy or how he should act with her, Ferguson decided to capitulate, to burn his arsenal of weapons and sign a mental treaty of absolute surrender. And from that moment on, he began to settle into his new job of acting as a brother to Amy's sister, knowing that was the only way he could go on loving her and still be loved in return. Sometimes they fought. Sometimes Amy shouted and slammed doors and called him names. Sometimes Ferguson hid in his room and refused to talk to her for entire evenings, entire blocks of 10 or 12 uninterrupted hours. But mostly they made an effort to get along, and mostly they did get along. In effect, their friendship returned to what it had been before Ferguson got it into his head that they should be more than just friends. But there was an added intensity to the friendship now that they were living with their newly married parents in the house on Woodhall Crescent, with longer, more intimate conversations that sometimes lasted 3 or 4 hours, and at some point always managed to come around to Amy's mother's death and Artie Fetterman's death, with more hours of studying and preparing for tests together, which pushed up Ferguson's grades from B pluses and occasional A minuses to Amy's level of all A's and A minuses, more cigarettes smoked together, more alcohol drunk together, almost all of it beer, cheap Rolling Rock in long green bottles, or even cheaper Old Milwaukee in the stumpy brown ones, more old movies watched on TV together, more records listened together, more games of gin rummy played together, more trips to New York together, more joking, more teasing, more arguing about politics, more laughing, and no more inhibitions about picking noses and farting in each other's company. The school had more than 2,100 students, just over 700 per grade, and in that factory of secondary public education that served the towns of Maplewood and South Orange, there was a mix of Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, a largely middle-class population, with a chunk from the blue-collar laboring class and another chunk from the upper strata of white-collar wealth, boys and girls whose families had come to America from England, Scotland, Italy, Ireland, Poland, Russia, Germany, Czechoslovakia, Greece, and Hungary, but not a single Asian family, and only 24 students of color in the entire school, making it one of the many one-color high schools in Essex County. And even at that late date, 19 and 20 years after the liberation of the death camps at the end of the Second World War, traces of anti-Semitism lingered on in the two towns, mostly in the form of whispers, silences, and unwritten exclusions at places such as the Orange Lawn Tennis Club. But sometimes it was worse than that, and neither Ferguson nor Amy ever forgot the cross that was burned on the front lawn of one of their Jewish friends from Maplewood the year they turned 10. More than two-thirds of the 700-plus students in their class would go on to attend college, some at the best private colleges in the country, some at mediocre private colleges along the eastern seaboard, some at state-run colleges in New Jersey, and for the boys who didn't attend college, there was the Army and Vietnam, and after that, if there wasn't after that, work as mechanics and gas pumpers at garages and filling stations, careers as bakers and long-distance truck drivers, fitful or steady employment as plumbers, electricians, and carpenters, 20-year stints in the police department, the fire department, and the sanitation department, or else shooting for the jackpot in high-risk trades such as gambling, extortion, and armed robbery. For the girls who didn't attend college, there was marriage and motherhood, secretarial school, nursing school, beautician school, dental technician school, work in offices, restaurants, and travel agencies, and the chance to spend the rest of their lives within 10 miles of the town where they were born. There were some exceptions, however, some girls who would not be going on to college and would not be staying put either. Some girls with altogether different pasts and futures from the homegrown New Jersey girls Ferguson had been studying all his life. And one such figure happened to turn up in his English class on the first day of his first year as a high school student. A dark-haired, dark-skinned girl who was neither pretty nor not pretty, but singularly arresting to Ferguson's eyes, all coiled into herself like an unafraid animal trapped in a zoo, calmly observing the observers through the bars, wondering which one would be brave enough to feed her. And when Mrs. Monroe began the session by pointing her finger at each of the 20 students and asking them to give their names and introduce themselves to the other members of the class, he heard the dark-haired girl speak with what he took to be a British accent, and without pausing to reflect on the matter, Ferguson made up his mind to pursue her, not only because a girl from somewhere else was automatically more desirable than a local girl from the Jersey suburbs, but because it had been exactly 7 days since Amy had rebuffed him in the backyard, and he was free, disgustingly free, to pursue any girl who crossed his path. Fortunately, Amy was not in his English class that year, which meant her eyes would not be looking at him as he looked at the dark-haired girl and plotted how to approach her, woo her, and win her over. And with no Amy around to spy on his intentions, He could make those intentions as transparent as he wished. Dana Rosenblum, not British but South African, the second of four daughters born to Maurice and Gladys Rosenblum in Johannesburg, currently residing in the United States because Dana's prosperous, factory-owning father was not only a capitalist entrepreneur, but a socialist, a man so opposed to the apartheid government that had been ruling the country since 1948 that he had actively worked against it. And by engaging in those subversive activities, he had offended the South African legal authorities to such an extent that they had wanted to put him in prison, a place that would not have been good for Maurice Rosenblum's health or the morale of his family. So off the six of them went, hightailing it out of South Africa to London, leaving behind their factory, their house in Johannesburg, their cars, their cats, their horse, their country house, their boat, and the better part of their money. From everything to nearly nothing. And with Dana's 62-year-old father too frail to work anymore, her much younger mother, whom Ferguson guessed to be somewhere in her mid-40s, had taken it upon herself to support the family in London, a task she had accomplished by rising to a position of great prominence at Harrods department store within 3 years. And having risen as far as she could go at Harrods, she had accepted a more important position for double the salary at Saks Fifth Avenue in New York. Thus, the Rosenblums landed on American soil in the spring of 1962, and thus they found their way to a large, creaking house on Mayhew Drive in South Orange, New Jersey, and thus Dana Rosenblum wound up sitting two desks over from Ferguson in Mrs. Monroe's 10th grade English class at Columbia High School. A white South African with the swart complexion of a North African. Eastern European origins layered upon older, deeper origins in Middle Eastern deserts. The exotic Jewess of Germanic and Nordic literature. The gypsy girl of 19th century operas and technicolor films. Esmeralda, Bathsheba, and Desdemona rolled into one. The black fire of crinkled, unruly hair burning like a crown on her head, slender limbs and narrow hips, a slight slouch to the shoulders and upper neck as she scratched out her notes in class. Languid movements, never rushed or frazzled, calm, mild and calm, not the Levantine temptress she appeared to be, but a solid girl with warm, affectionate impulses. In many ways, the most ordinary girl Ferguson had ever been attracted to. Not beautiful in the way Linda Flagg was beautiful, not brilliant in the way Amy was brilliant, but older and more poised than either one of them because of what she and her family had been through. Older than Ferguson himself, an untormented sensualist with enough experience and daring to make her receptive to his early advances, and before long he understood that she was crazy about him and would never hack him to pieces as Amy sometimes did. The disputatious Schneiderman, who burst out laughing when Ferguson pulled out a pipe and lit it after dinner one evening during the year of many dinners, before their parents were married. The pipe he had bought to smoke while writing because he thought all writers were meant to smoke pipes when they sat at their desks and wrote. And how thoroughly she had mocked him for that, calling him a pretentious oaf and the silliest boy who had ever lived, words that Dana Rosenblum never would have spoken to him or anyone else. And so he courted the dark-eyed newcomer from Johannesburg and London and won her over, not because he knew what he was doing when it came to the art of seduction, but because she had fallen for him and wanted to be seduced. He wasn't in love with her. He would never be in love with her. Right from the start, he understood that Dana would never be the grand passion he was looking for. But his body needed to be touched. He craved intimacy with someone. And Dana touched him and kissed him well, so well and so often that the physical pleasures obtained by her caresses all but obliterated the need for a grand passion at that point in his life. A little passion with a lot of touching and kissing was enough for now. And when they broke through to bare skin all-out sex in the winter of their junior year, it was more than enough to satisfy him. Wordless animal sex with the gypsy girl who loved him. Communication by looks and gestures and touch. few verbal exchanges about anything but the most trivial matters. Not a meeting of minds, as with Amy, or the future girl of his dreams, but a meeting of bodies, an understanding between bodies, a lack of inhibition that was so new to Ferguson that he sometimes trembled when he thought about what they did to each other in the empty rooms where they managed to be alone together. Skin burning with happiness, sweat flowing from their pores as they slathered each other with kisses, and how kind she was to him, how accepting of his funks and self-indulgent despairs, how unconcerned that he loved her less than she loved him. But they both knew their connection was no more than a temporary business, that America was his place and not hers, and for now she was just biding her time until graduation and her 18th birthday, when she would be heading off to Israel to live on a kibbutz between the Sea of Galilee and the Golan Heights. That was all she wanted. No college, no books, no big ideas, just planting her body in a place with other bodies and doing whatever she had to do in order to belong to a country that would never kick her out. Inevitably, there were times when he felt bored with her, disengaged because she cared so little about the things that were most important to him. And all through the years they were in school together, he wobbled and drifted, set his sights on other girls, took up with other girls during the summers when Dana visited her relatives in Tel Aviv. But he couldn't ever break with her entirely. Her sweetness kept luring him back. The sweetness of her good heart was irresistible, and the sex was necessary, the one thing that blotted out all the other things for the minutes or hours it lasted, and seemed to make him understand why he had been born, and what it meant to belong to the world, the beginning of erotic life, the beginning of real life. And none of that would have been possible with any other girl in the school. The Linda Flags and Nora McGinty's and Debbie Kleinman's were all militant virgins, professional maidens locked up in iron chastity belts, and therefore, even if his affections wavered from time to time, he knew how lucky he was to have found Dana Rosenblum and would never let go of her until he had to. For beyond giving herself to him, Dana had also given him her family. And Ferguson had come to love that family, love the very idea that such a family could exist. And every time he stepped into their house and was engulfed by the Rosenblumian aura, felt so happy to be there, he didn't want to leave. What that aura was seemed to elude any precise definition. Although Ferguson made numerous attempts over the years to understand what made it so distinctive, so unlike any other household he had entered before. A mixture of the posh and the humdrum, he sometimes thought, but one in which the poshness was never tainted by the humdrumness, and the humdrum was never influenced by the posh. The elegant, beautifully controlled British manners of the parents, flourishing side by side with the anarchic tendencies of the children. Yet neither camp seemed to resent the other, and an air of peacefulness seemed to hover around the house at all times, even when the two youngest daughters were shouting at each other in the living room. One snapshot. The tall, slim, aristocratic Mrs. Rosenblum in one of the Chanel and Dior suits she wore to her office at Saks Fifth Avenue, patiently talking about birth control to her eldest daughter, Bella, who had gone beatnik since her arrival in America and was listening patiently to her mother as she adjusted her black turtleneck sweater and brushed on black eyeliner, which slowly transformed her into a raccoon. A second snapshot. The smallish, somewhat emaciated Mr. Rosenblum with his silk ascot and gray goatee, discoursing on the virtues of good penmanship to his youngest daughter, Leslie, a scrawny 9-year-old with scabs on her knees and a pet hamster named Rodolfo sleeping in a pocket of her dress. Such was the Rosenblumian aura, or one or two of its transient emanations. And when Ferguson considered the turmoil those people had gone through together, when he thought about what it must have been like to lose everything and have to start all over again in another part of the world, and then have to start over again for a second time in yet another part of the world, he wondered if he had ever met a braver, more resilient family than this one. That was the aura, too. We're alive, and from now on it's live and let live, and may the gods turn their backs on us and butt out of our affairs for good. There was much to learn from Mr. Rosenblum, Ferguson decided, and because Dana's 66-year-old father no longer worked and spent most of his days at home reading books and smoking cigarettes, Ferguson began stopping in to see him from time to time, most often immediately after school, when the late afternoon light would flow into the living room and cast complex, crisscrossing shadows on the floor and furniture. And there they would sit, the young man and the old man, in that half-dark, half-bright room, talking about nothing in particular, rambling around among politics and the peculiarities of American life, occasionally discussing a book or a film or a painting, but the bulk of it was Mr. Rosenblum telling stories about the past, frivolous, charming anecdotes about storm-tossed voyages on steamship liners to Europe, the bon mot he had uttered as a young man, the shock of delight that coursed through him when he took the first sip of his first martini, references to gramophone records, the wireless, and rolled-up silk stockings sliding off women's legs. Nothing of any consequence, nothing of any depth, but fascinating to listen to, and how rarely he talked about his troubles in South Africa, Ferguson noticed. And when he did say something, there was never any rancor in his voice, none of the anger or indignation that might have been expected from a man in exile. And that was why Ferguson was so drawn to Mr. Rosenblum and took such pleasure in his company. Not because he was a man who had suffered, but because he was a man who had suffered and could still crack jokes. Mr. Rosenblum never read any of Ferguson's stories, never even glanced at a single word Ferguson had written. But of all people, he was the one who came up with the solution to a problem that had vexed Ferguson for many months and no doubt would have gone on plaguing him for years. "Archie," the old man said one afternoon, "a nice name for everyday use, but not a very good name for a novelist, is it?" "No," Ferguson said, "it's tragically inappropriate." "And Archibald isn't much better, is it?" "No, not any better at all. Worse." "So what are you going to do when you start publishing your work?" "If I ever do start publishing, you mean." "Well, let's assume that you will. Do you have any alternatives in mind?" "Not really." "Not really, or not at all?" "Not at all." "Hmm," Mr. Rosenblum said, as he lit up a cigarette and looked off into the shadows. After a long pause, he asked, "What about your middle name? Do you have one?" "Isaac." Mr. Rosenblum exhaled a large plume of smoke and repeated the two syllables he had just heard. "Isaac." "It was my grandfather's name." "Isaac Ferguson." "Isaac Ferguson, as in Isaac Babel and Isaac Bashevis Singer." "A fine Jewish name, don't you think?" "Not so much the Ferguson part, but definitely the Isaac part." "Isaac Ferguson, novelist. Archie Ferguson, the man. Isaac Ferguson, the writer." "Not bad, I'd say. What do you say?" "Not bad at all." "Two people in one. Or one person in two. Either way, it's good. Either way, that's the name I'll use to sign my work. Isaac Ferguson. If I ever manage to get published, of course." "Don't be so modest. When you manage to get published." 6 months after that conversation, as the two of them sat in the house discussing the differences between the light of South African afternoons and the light of New Jersey afternoons, Mr. Rosenblum stood up from his chair, walked to the far end of the room, and came back with a book in his hand. "Maybe you should read this," he said, as he gently let the book fall from his hand into Ferguson's hand. It was Alan Paton's Cry the Beloved Country, a story of comfort and desolation. Published by Jonathan Cape, 30 Bedford Square, London. Ferguson thanked Mr. Rosenblum and promised to return the book within the next 3 or 4 days. "You don't have to give it back," Mr. Rosenblum said as he sat down in his chair again. "It's for you, Archie. I don't need it anymore." Ferguson opened the book and saw that there was an inscription on the first page that read, "September 23rd, 1948. Many happy birthdays, Maurice, Tilly, and Ben." Under the two signatures, written out in thick block letters, there were two more words. "Hold fast." If he wasn't going to take money from his father, then it was out of the question to spend another summer working in one of his stores. At the same time, if Ferguson wouldn't take money from his father, then he would have to start earning money of his own. But two-month summer jobs were hard to come by in that part of the world, and he didn't know where to look for one. Now that he was 16, he supposed he could go back to Camp Paradise and work as a waiter there, but he would earn nothing except for the tips the parents handed out on the last day of the summer, which would amount to a paltry $200 or so. And besides, Ferguson was finished with camp and never wanted to go back. The mere thought of setting foot on the ground where he had seen Artie Fetterman die was enough to make him see the death again, see it again and again, until it was Ferguson himself who was emitting the faint little O that came from Artie's mouth. Ferguson himself who was falling down on the grass. Ferguson himself who was dead. And it simply wouldn't be possible to go there, not even if the salary for camp waiters was $400 a meal. In the spring of his sophomore year, with his mother's wedding already announced for early August and no solution in sight, Jim put Ferguson in touch with one of his old high school friends, a 230-pound ex-football tackle named Arnie Frazier, who had flunked out of Rutgers in his freshman year and was running a moving business in Maplewood and South Orange. The fleet consisted of one Chevy van, and the operation was an under-the-table affair transacted on a strictly cash-only basis, with no insurance, no bonded employees, no formal business structure, and no taxes paid because no income was declared. Even though Ferguson wouldn't be old enough to drive until next March, Frazier took him on as a shotgun man to replace his current sidekick, who had been drafted into the army and would be heading off to Fort Dix at the end of June. Jim's friend would have preferred a full-time, year-round worker, but Jim was Frazier's friend because he had once rescued Frazier's twin sister from a touchy situation at a high school party, decking a drunken lacrosse player who was pawing her in a corner of the room. And Frazier felt he owed Jim and couldn't say no. That was how Ferguson got his foot in the door and began his career as a moving man, which lasted for all three of his high school summers from 1963 to 1965, since his services were required again the next year when the new shotgun man was forced to quit because of a herniated disc in his lower back, and again the third year when the fleet expanded to two vans and Frazier was in urgent need of a second driver. It was strenuous work at times, and every year when Ferguson started up again, half the muscles in his body would be excruciatingly sore for the first 6 or 7 days, but he found manual work to be a good counterbalance to the mental work of writing. For not only did it keep him in good physical shape and serve a legitimate purpose, moving people's belongings from one place to another, it allowed him to think his own thoughts rather than have to give his thoughts to someone else, which was the case with most non-manual work. Helping someone else make money with your brains while getting as little as possible for it in return. And even if Ferguson's salary was low, every job ended with $5 and $10 and sometimes $20 bills being shoved into his hand. And because work was abundant during those years before the millions burned on Vietnam wrecked the national economy, he wound up earning close to 200 tax-free dollars every week. So Ferguson spent those three summers lugging beds and sofas up and down narrow staircases, delivering antique mirrors and Louis XV escritoires to interior decorators in New York, moving college students in and out of their dorm rooms on campuses in Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, hauling old refrigerators and broken-down air conditioners to the town dump, and in the process he met many people who never would have brushed up against his life if he had been sitting in an office or making ice cream cones for noisy children at Grunning's. More than that, Arnie treated him well and seemed to respect him. And while it was true that Ferguson's 21-year-old boss voted for Goldwater in the 64 election and wanted to drop nuclear bombs on Hanoi, it was also true that the same Arnie Frazier hired two black men when the second van was bought and the crew expanded to four. And the last summer Ferguson worked for him brought the inestimable bonus of riding around every day with one of those black men, Richard Brinkerstaff, a broad, big-bellied giant who had looked through the windshield of the van as Ferguson drove them to their next destination, carefully absorbing the passing landscapes of empty suburban roads and potholed city streets and crowded industrial highways. And again and again, in the same tone of voice, whether he was talking about something that delighted him or saddened him or repelled him, he would point his finger at the little girl playing with her collie on the front lawn of her house, or the disheveled wino staggering through the intersection at Bowery and Canal, and say, "How sweet it is, Archie, how sweet it is." Ferguson knew that his father had no idea what to make of him, not just because he found it impossible to understand why anyone would want to go into such an iffy field as writing books, which struck him as a delusional folly, an all but certain descent into impoverishment, failure, and mind-shattering disappointment, but also because his properly raised son, who had been exposed to the benefits of traditional, up-from-the-bootstraps American enterprise from the day of his birth, now shunned the opportunities that had been given to him for advancement and success in life to fritter away his summers working as a common laborer, toiling under an idiot college dropout who cheated the IRS. There was nothing wrong with the money he was earning, but the problem was that it would never become more money, for bottom-rung work of that sort would always keep him at the bottom. And when his son started talking about supporting himself in the future as a factory worker or a sailor in the merchant marine, the father cringed at the thought of what would become of him. What had happened to the little boy who had wanted to be a doctor? Why had everything gone so wrong? That was how Ferguson imagined his father must have thought about him, if in fact he did think about him. And in the 2- and 3-page monologues he wrote in his father's voice, he struggled to understand his father's way of thinking, digging down and trying to excavate the few things he knew about Stanley Ferguson's early life. The difficult, no-money years, when his grandfather was murdered and his screaming, quasi-hysterical grandmother took charge of the clan, and then the mysterious departure of his father's 2 older brothers to California, never fully explained, never fully understood, and after that the push to become the richest man on earth, the great prophet of prophets who believed in money as other people believed in God or sex or good works, money as salvation and fulfillment, money as the ultimate measure of all things, and anyone who resisted that belief was either a fool or a coward, as his ex-wife and son were surely fools and cowards, their brains stuffed with the romantic claptrap dished out by novels and cheap Hollywood films, and his ex-wife was mostly to blame for what had happened, his once beloved Rose, who had turned the boy's head away from his father and coddled him with all that soft-minded nonsense about discovering his true self and forging his own unique destiny, and now it was too late to undo the damage, and the boy was lost. Still, none of that explained why his father continued to nod off in front of movie and TV screens, or why, as his wealth had grown, he had become cheaper and more tight-fisted, and took his son only to lousy, inexpensive restaurants for their twice-monthly dinners, or why he had changed his mind about selling the house in Maplewood and had moved back in after Ferguson and his mother had left, or why, after going to the trouble of having soulmates printed, he never asked to see any of Ferguson's news stories, never inquired about how he was getting on with his stepfather and step-siblings in the house on Woodhall Crescent, never asked what college he wanted to go to, never said a word about the Kennedy assassination, or seemed to care that the president had been shot. And the more Ferguson tried to tunnel his way into his father's soul, searching for something that wasn't dead or cut off from other people, the less he was able to find. Even the complex Mr. Rosenblum, who no doubt hid much, if not most, of his inner life from the world, made more sense to Ferguson than his father did. Nor could the differences between them be boiled down to the fact that his father worked and Mr. Rosenblum didn't. Dan Schneiderman worked, not the 12- and 14-hour days his father put in, but a steady 7 to 8 hours, 5 or 6 days a week. And even if he wasn't the most dazzling artist in the world, he knew the limitations of his modest talent and took pleasure in his work, which he did well enough to cobble together a living as a, quote, self-employed artisan of the brush, as he sometimes put it. Not the big money income Stanley Ferguson raked in, of course, but a more generous heart in spite of that, as shown by the new car he had bought for his new wife, which turned Ferguson and Amy into joint owners of her old Pontiac when they passed the test for their licenses, by the clever mobiles and whirling little mechanical sculptures he made as presents for everyone's birthday, by the surprise outings to restaurants, concerts, and films, by the allowance he insisted on giving Ferguson along with the one he gave his daughter, shelling out weekly to both of them because he wanted their summer earnings to be deposited in the bank and not touched while they were still in high school. But most of all, by the generosity of his person, his high spirits and loving solicitudes, his boyishness, his whimsy, his passion for poker and all games of chance, his somewhat reckless disregard of tomorrow in favor of today, which added up to a man so different from Ferguson's father that the son/stepson had trouble reconciling them as members of the same species. Then there was Dan's older brother, Gilbert Schneiderman, Ferguson's new, impressively intelligent uncle, who worked as hard as anyone else, teaching music history full-time at Juilliard and writing entry after entry on classical composers for a soon-to-be-published music encyclopedia. And Uncle Don worked as well. The intense, sometimes crabby father of best friend Noah never stopped working as he plugged away at his Montaigne biography and spilled forth 2 and sometimes 3 book reviews a month. And even Arnie Frazier worked, the flunk-out 4F IRS chiseling ex-football player, worked his ass off, as Ferguson well knew, but that didn't prevent him from drinking a 6-pack of Löwenbräu every night and keeping up amorous relations with 3 different girls from 3 different towns at the same time. Ferguson tried not to feel angry when he was with his father, even though he was appalled by how willing the appliance king had been to let Dan Schneiderman give him the money for his allowance, which legally and morally should have been given to him by his father. But Ferguson suspected his father was angry as well, not so much at him, but at his mother, who not only had pressed for the divorce but had remarried so soon afterward. And by abdicating his responsibility toward his son, Ferguson's father had his miser's reward of not having to part with his money when he didn't want to, which was almost always now, along with the additional satisfaction of sticking it to his ex-wife's new husband. Fun and games in the flea circus of petty animosities and tortures, Ferguson said to himself, as his heart contracted ever more tightly within him. But perhaps it was just as well that his father had reneged on his allowance obligation, since Ferguson would have refused the money if it had been offered to him, and he didn't want to confront his father with the decision he had made not to accept his money, which would have been seen as an act of hostility, something close to a declaration of war. Ferguson wasn't looking to pick a fight with his father. He just wanted to endure their meetings as quietly as possible and have nothing happen that would cause either one of them pain. No money from his father, and no baseball because Artie Fetterman's ghost was still walking beside him, and Ferguson wouldn't back down from his promise. Other sports were permitted, but none of them had ever counted as much as baseball. And after starting at forward for the JV basketball team in his first year of high school, Ferguson decided not to go out for the varsity the following year, which brought an abrupt and definitive end to his participation in organized sports. It had once meant everything to him, but that was before he had read Crime and Punishment, before he had discovered sex with Dana Rosenblum, before he had smoked his first cigarette and downed his first drink, before he had become the future writer who spent his evenings alone in his room filling up his precious notebooks with words. And while he still loved sports and would never think of abandoning them, they had been relegated to the category of idle amusements, touch football, pick-up basketball games, ping-pong in the basement of the new house, and occasional Sunday morning tennis with Dan, his mother, and Amy, for the most part doubles matches, either children versus parents or father-daughter versus mother-son. Recreational diversions as opposed to the do-or-die battles of his boyhood. Play hard, work up a sweat, win the game or lose the game, and then go back home for a shower and a smoke. But it was still beautiful to him, especially the sport he cared about most, forbidden baseball, which he would never play again, and he kept on pulling for his newly invented team from Flushing, even if the fate of the Western world no longer hung in the balance when Choo-Choo Coleman stepped into the batter's box with two outs and two men on in the bottom of the ninth. His stepfather and stepbrother would groan when the inevitable third strike was called, but Ferguson would merely nod or shake his head and then stand up and calmly turn off the TV. The Choo-Choo Colemans of this world had been born to strike out, and the Mets wouldn't have been the Mets if he hadn't. Two dinners every month with his father, and one dinner every other month with the Fettermans in New Rochelle, a ritual Ferguson held fast to in spite of his misgivings, since it was never clear to him why Artie's parents kept asking him back, and even less clear why he found himself willing to make the long trek out there to see them, when in fact he wasn't willing, when in fact each one of those dinners filled him with dread. Murky. Their motives escaped him, for neither he nor the Fettermans understood what they were doing, or why they persisted in doing it. And yet the impulse had been there from the start. Mrs. Fetterman throwing her arms around him after the funeral and telling him he would always be part of the family. Ferguson, sitting beside 12-year-old Celia in the living room for 2 hours, struggling to find the words to say he was her brother now and would always take care of her. Why had they said those things and thought those things? And what did any of it mean? He and Artie had been friends for only 1 month. Long enough to have turned into the AF twins, long enough to have felt they were at the beginning of what would be a long and close friendship, but not long enough for either one of them to have become a part of the other's family. At the time of his friend's death, Ferguson had never even set eyes on Ralph and Shirley Fetterman. He hadn't even known their names, but they had known about him because of the letters their son had written from Camp Paradise. Those letters were crucial. The shy, untalkative Artie had opened up to them about his new and wonderful friend, and therefore his parents were already convinced that Ferguson was wonderful before they ever met him. Then Artie died, and 3 days later, the wonderful friend showed up at the funeral, not the spitting image of their son, but a boy much like him, tall and strong, with the same young athlete's body, the same Jewish background, the same good marks at school, and for such a boy to enter their lives at the precise moment they had lost their son, the very boy their son had referred to as a brother, must have had a powerful effect on them, Ferguson reasoned, an uncanny effect, as if their vanished boy had outmaneuvered the gods and sent them another boy to stand in for him, a changeling son from the world of the living, swapped for the one who had died. And by keeping up contact with Ferguson, they could see what would have happened to their own boy as he slowly grew up and turned into a man. The gradual shifts that made a 15-year-old different from a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old different from a 15-year-old, a 17-year-old different from a 16-year-old, and an 18-year-old different from a 17-year-old. It was a kind of performance, Ferguson realized, and every time he traveled to New Rochelle for another Sunday dinner, he had to take on the job of pretending to be himself by being himself, by enacting himself as fully and truthfully as he could. For they all knew they were playing a game, even if they weren't aware they knew. And Archie would never be Artie, not just because he didn't want to be, but because the living could never replace the dead. They were good people, kind people, unexceptional people, and they lived in a little white house on a tree-lined street with other little white houses, owned by other hard-working middle-class families with two or three children and a car or two cars in the white wooden garage. Ralph Fetterman was a tall, thin man in his late 40s who had trained as a pharmacist and owned the smallest of the three drugstores on the main street of the New Rochelle shopping district. Shirley Fetterman, also tall but not thin, was a few years younger than her husband. A graduate of Hunter College, she worked part-time at the local library, canvassed for Democratic candidates during state and national elections, and had a thing for Broadway musicals. They both treated Ferguson with a quiet sort of deference, a bit shocked perhaps, and also grateful that he went on accepting their invitations out of loyalty to their son. And because they didn't want to lose him, they tended to sit back at the dinners and let Ferguson do most of the talking. As for Celia, she rarely said a word, but she listened to him, listened more closely than either of her parents did. And as Ferguson watched her evolve from a timid, grieving child into a self-possessed girl of 16, it occurred to him that she was the reason why he kept going back there. For it had always been apparent to him how bright she was, but now she was becoming pretty too, a slender, swan-like, long-limbed kind of prettiness. And even though she was still too young for him, in another year or two she wouldn't be. And lodged somewhere in a deep, inaccessible part of Ferguson's brain was the unformed idea that he was destined to marry Celia Fetterman, that the narrative of his life demanded he marry her in order to negate the injustice of her brother's early death. It was essential that he talk, that he not just sit there making polite conversation, but really talk, telling them everything he could about himself so they would begin to understand who he was. And more after the first few visits, that was what he did, talk to them about himself and the things that were happening to him. Because by then, there was less and less to say about Artie. It was too gruesome to keep going over the same ground again and again, and Ferguson could see with his own eyes how, in the course of 9 months, Mr. Fetterman's hair had gone from dark brown to a mix of brown and gray to mostly gray and then to all white. How Artie's father grew much thinner for a time, and his mother kept putting on weight. 10 more pounds by October 1961, 15 more pounds by March 1962, 20 more pounds by September. Their bodies were telling Ferguson what was happening to their souls as they went on living with Artie's death. And there was no need to discuss their son's exploits as a 10-year-old little leaguer anymore. No need to mention his A pluses in science and math ever again. And so Ferguson came up with a new strategy for getting through those dinners, which was to push Artie out of the room and force them to think about something else. Never a word about giving up baseball because of their son. Never a word about his lustful thoughts toward Amy Schneiderman. Never a word about having sex with Dana Rosenblum. Never a word about the night he drank too much with Amy's boyfriend, Mike Loeb, and wound up puking all over his pants and shoes. But other than hiding those secrets and indiscretions, Ferguson made a point of not censoring himself, a difficult task for someone as reticent as he was. But he trained himself to be honest with them, to perform for them. And at the 24 New Rochelle dinners he attended over the 4 years between Artie's death and his graduation from high school, he talked about many things, including the various upheavals that had occurred in his family, his parents' divorce, his mother's second marriage, his frigid relations with his father, and the curious experience of having acquired a new set of relatives, not just his stepfather and 2 step-siblings, but Dan's brother Gil, an erudite and sympathetic man who took an interest in his step-nephew's writerly aspirations. "You have to learn everything you can, Archie," he once said to him, "and then you have to forget it. And what you can't forget will create the foundation of your work." And Gil's dour wife, Anna, and his plump, smirking daughters, Margaret and Ella, along with Dan's crotchety old father, who lived in a room on the 3rd floor of a nursing home in Washington Heights and was either cracked or in the early stages of dementia. But still, he did come out with some unforgettable remarks from time to time in that Sig Ruman accent of his, "I want we all shut up now so I can piss." One of the best results of his mother's marriage, he told them, was that by some mysterious sleight of hand, which had strung together so many different families and overlapping lineages, his dearest friend and cousin by marriage, Noah Marks, was now related to his new stepsister and stepbrother as well. Cousins by marriage once or twice removed, no one was quite sure which, a fact that made him dizzy every time he thought about it. Noah and Amy bound together with him in the same mixed-up tribe, and what an improvement it was to see how well Dan Schneiderman hit it off with Donald Marks, which had not been the case with his father, who had disliked Uncle Don and had once called him a pompous schmuck, and this was better, Ferguson said, even if his mother's relations with her sister had not improved and never would, but at least now it was possible to sit down and have dinner with the Marxes without wanting to scream or pull out a gun and shoot someone. He could tell them things he never told anyone else, which made him a different person when he was with them, a more forthright and entertaining person than he was at home or at school, a person who could make people laugh. And perhaps that was another reason why he kept on going back there, because he knew that they would listen to the stories he told, the amusing anecdotes about Noah, for example, someone he never tired of bringing into the conversation, his staunch fellow traveler to the thickets of life, who had been given a full scholarship to the Fieldston School in Riverdale, one of the best private schools in the city, the taller, post-wire-toothed Noah, who had managed to find himself a girlfriend and was directing plays at Fieldston, contemporary stuff like The Chairs and The Bald Soprano by Ionesco, older stuff like The White Devil by John Webster, what a bloodbath, and making little movies with his Bell and Howell 8mm camera. Still one of the world's most cunning saboteurs, he accompanied Ferguson on the second of his semi-monthly meetings with his father in May 1964. Not to a cheap restaurant this time, but to the dreaded Blue Valley Country Club, an invitation Ferguson rashly accepted by insisting Noah be included in the party, a proposal he assumed his father would reject, but his father surprised him by agreeing to his demand, and so the Appliance King and the two boys set out one Sunday afternoon for lunch at the club. And because Noah knew all about Ferguson's struggles with his father and how much he detested that club, he mocked the place and the things it stood for by wearing a plaid tam-o'-shanter with a white pom-pom on top for the occasion, such a ludicrous, oversized headpiece that Ferguson and his father both laughed when they saw it, perhaps the only time they had laughed in unison for more than a decade. But Noah deadpanned it and didn't crack a smile, which made a funny thing even funnier, of course, telling them that this was his first visit to a golf club and he wanted to look right, since golf was a Scottish game, and therefore all golfers must needs, he actually said must needs, adorn themselves with Scottish hats as they worked their way around the links. It was true that Noah got a little carried away once they arrived at the club, perhaps because he felt uncomfortable to be rubbing shoulders with what he called the filthy rich, or perhaps because he wanted to show his solidarity with Ferguson by saying out loud what Ferguson himself would never have dared to say, as when an obese man waddled by, pointed to the tam-o'-shanter and called out, "Nice hat," to which Noah replied with an enormous grin plastered across his face, "Thanks, fatso." But Ferguson's father was walking 10 or 12 feet in front of them and missed the insult, thus sparing the boys the dressing down that would have been given to them if he had heard it. And for once, Ferguson managed to get through a day at the Blue Valley Country Club without wishing he were somewhere else. That was one side of Noah, he told the Fettermans, the zany agent provocateur, an impish clown, but at bottom he was a thoughtful, serious person, and nothing proved that more than how he had behaved on the weekend Kennedy was shot. By pure happenstance, Noah had been invited to come out to New Jersey to spend a couple of days and nights with Ferguson and Amy in the new house on Woodhall Crescent. The plan was to make a movie together with his 8mm camera, a silent adaptation of Ferguson's short story, What Happened, the one about the boy who runs away from home and returns to find his parents missing, with Noah cast as the boy and Ferguson and Amy as the parents. Then, on Friday, November 22nd, just hours before Noah was supposed to leave New York from the Port Authority bus terminal, Kennedy was shot and killed in Dallas. It would have made sense for him to cancel the visit, but Noah didn't want to, and he called to tell them to pick him up at the Irvington bus station as scheduled. They all watched television for the entire weekend, Ferguson and his stepfather sitting together at one end of the long sofa in the living room, and Amy and her stepmother curled up together at the other end, Rose with her arms around Amy, and Amy with her head resting on Rose's shoulder. And Noah had the wit to take out his camera and film them, all four of them for the better part of 2 days. moving back and forth between their faces and the black-and-white images on the television screen. The face of Walter Cronkite, Johnson, and Jackie Kennedy on the plane as the vice president was sworn in as the new president. Jack Ruby shooting Oswald in a corridor of the Dallas police station, the riderless horse, and John John's salute on the day of the burial procession. All those public events alternating with the four people on the sofa, grim-faced Dan Schneiderman, his blank, burned-out stepson, and the two wet-eyed women watching those events on the screen, all in silence, of course, since the camera couldn't record sound, a mass of footage that must have come to 10 or 12 hours, an intolerable length that no one could have sat through from start to finish. But then Noah took the rolls of film back to New York, found a professional editor to help him, and cut those hours down to 27 minutes. And the result was stupendous, Ferguson said. A national catastrophe written across the faces of those four people and the television set in front of them. A real film by a 16-year-old boy that was more than just a historical document, but a work of art as well. Or, as Ferguson expressed it, using the word he always used when describing something he loves, a masterpiece. There were many stories about Noah, but also about Amy and Jim, about his mother and grandparents, about Arnie Fraser and their near crack-up on the New Jersey Turnpike, about Dana Rosenblum and her family, about his talks with Mr. Rosenblum, and about his friendship with Mike Loeb, Amy's boyfriend, then ex-boyfriend, then boyfriend Redux, who not only knew who Emma Goldman was and had read her autobiography, Living My Life, but was the only person in the school who had also read Alexander Berkman's Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist. Beefy Mike Loeb, budding anti-Soviet Marxist radical, who believed in the movement, in organizing, and mass action, and consequently took a dim view of Ferguson's interest in Thoreau, who was all about the individual, the solitary man of conscience, acting out of moral principle but with no theoretical foundation for attacking the system, for rebuilding society from the bottom up and the top down. An excellent writer, yes, but what a pinched and prudish fellow he was, and so frightened of women he probably went to his grave a virgin. Celia, 14 at the time, snickered when Ferguson repeated those words. And even if his idea of civil disobedience had been picked up by Gandhi, King, and others in the civil rights movement, passive resistance wasn't enough. Sooner or later it would come down to armed struggle. And that was why Mike preferred Malcolm X to M.L. King and had taped a poster of Mao to his bedroom wall. No, Ferguson replied when Artie's parents asked if he agreed with this boy, but that was what made their conversation so instructive, he said, because every time Mike challenged him, he would have to think harder about what he believed in himself, and how could you ever learn anything if you only talked to people who thought exactly as you did. Then there was Mrs. Monroe, his favorite subject of all, the one person who made life as a high school student bearable. And the great good luck to have had her as his English teacher for both his sophomore and junior years. The young and spirited Evelyn Monroe, just 28 when Ferguson entered her class for the first time. The vibrant antidote to the dowdy, reactionary, anti-modernist Mrs. Baldwin. Monroe, nay Ferrante, a tough Italian girl from the Bronx, who rode off to Vassar on a full scholarship, formerly married to jazz saxophonist Bobby Monroe, frequenter of village hangouts, friend of musicians, artists, actors, and poets, the hippest teacher ever to grace the halls of Columbia High School. And what separated her from all the other teachers Ferguson had ever had was that she looked upon her students as fully formed, independent human beings. Young grown-ups, rather than large children, which had the effect of making them all feel good about themselves when they sat in her class and listened to her talk about the books she had assigned. Mr. Joyce, Mr. Shakespeare, Mr. Melville, Miss Dickinson, Mr. Eliot, Miss Eliot, Miss Wharton, Mr. Fitzgerald, Miss Cather, and all the rest. And there wasn't a single student in either one of the two classes Ferguson took with her who didn't adore Mrs. Monroe. But no one more than Ferguson himself, who showed her every one of the stories he wrote throughout high school, even in the last year when she wasn't his teacher anymore. Not that she was a better judge than Uncle Don or Aunt Mildred were, he supposed, but he felt she was more honest with him than they were, more detailed in her criticisms, and at the same time more encouraging, as if it were a foregone conclusion that he had been born to do this, and no other choice was possible. She kept a sign posted above the blackboard, a sentence from the American poet Kenneth Rexroth, that she had copied out in letters large enough to be read by someone in the back row. And because Ferguson often found himself looking at the sign during class, he later calculated that he must have read it several thousand times during the years he studied with her. Against the ruin of the world, there is only one defense, the creative act. Mrs. Fetterman said, "Every young person needs a Mrs. Monroe, Archie, but not every young person gets one." "What a frightening thought," Ferguson said. "I don't know what I'd do without her." New York kept pulling at him, and Ferguson continued to go there as often as he could on his free Saturdays, sometimes alone, sometimes with Dana Rosenblum, sometimes with Amy and Mike Loeb, sometimes just with Mike Loeb, and sometimes with all three of them together, where he and they would link up with Noah on the weekends when young Groucho was camping out in the village with his father and Mildred, or just with his father if Uncle Don and Aunt Mildred happened to be living apart again. Density, immensity, complexity. As Ferguson once put it, when asked why he preferred the city to the suburbs, a sentiment shared by all five members of his little gang, and except for Dana, who had already made up her mind about where she wanted to go after high school, the other four decided they should all stay in New York for college. That meant Columbia for the three boys and Barnard for Amy, assuming they were accepted there, which seemed likelier, more than just a long shot because of their strong records, but even though three of them managed to get in, only one of them wound up moving to Morningside Heights the following September. Noah, the rejected applicant, had brought the defeat upon himself by cultivating a new habit in the summer after his junior year, and so fond did he become of smoking pot that he temporarily lost interest in school, which caused his grades and test scores to crash in the first semester of his senior year, and Columbia, which was his father's alma mater, the place where everyone in his family hoped he would be spending the next 4 years, turned him down. Noah laughed it off. He would be going to NYU instead, which would allow him to stay in New York as planned, and even though it was universally recognized as a worse college than Columbia, with a mediocre undergraduate program for listless, unmotivated students, NYU would give him the chance to study filmmaking, a subject not offered to Columbia undergraduates. And besides, he said, he would be living downtown in the coolest part of the city, rather than that shithole slum wedged between Harlem and the Hudson River. Noah to Washington Square, Mike to the uptown grid at West 116th Street between Broadway and Amsterdam Avenue, and Ferguson and his stepsister to colleges beyond the borders of the city. Amy's decision had everything to do with Mike. They had already broken up once before, when he cheated on her with a girl named Moira Oppenheim in the middle of their junior year. But after a protracted separation that had ended with groveling gestures of contrition from Mike, Amy had given him another chance, and now, just 4 months later, he had gone off and done it again, betraying her with the same Moira Oppenheim, no less, the mousy little tramp who wouldn't take no for an answer. And Amy was fed up, furious, and finished with Mike for good. The letters from the colleges she had applied to landed in the mailbox on Woodhall Crescent the following week. Yes from Barnard and yes from Brandeis, her first and second choices. And because she wanted to be nowhere near Mike Loeb or ever have to look at his fat face and bloated body again, she said no to New York and yes to Waltham, Massachusetts, convinced that the one would be just as good as the other, and relieved that she had no second thoughts about her decision. The pig had humiliated her and broken her heart. Ferguson agreed that she would be better off going somewhere else, and just to prove how much he was on her side, he offered to give her the Pontiac they owned together when she left for Massachusetts in the fall, and to cut off his friendship with Mike Loeb right now, starting this minute.